Welcome to the Focus Bonus Show, where we do nothing about productivity. I am David Sparks, joined by my co-host, Mike Schmitz.
Hey, David, how's it going?
Good. I'm actually super happy because we're doing something very special for this year's bonus episode. One thing that we're doing is special is we brought in our pal, Joe Buehlig. Hey, Joe.
Hello, team. Thanks for having me today.
Joe co-hosts with Mike's separate podcast about reading books called Bookworm, where they read a book a week, but famously, Mike Schmitz refuses to read fiction.
That is right.
And when we were talking about this show, I just pitched the idea, hey, why don't you read a fiction book, Mike? And the answer was immediately no. It wasn't like he paused. He didn't pause to think about it. It was just like, no. You know, it's just like if someone said to me, why don't you jump off a building? I would just say, no, I wouldn't, you know, wouldn't think about it very long. But Mike was that way about fiction. And I know, Joe, you've also been trying to get him to read a fiction book.
Absolutely.
But we all should have known the person that convinced Mike to read a fiction book was not David or Joe. It was Mike's son.
That's true. My 11-year-old son is into Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. So he asked me to read the books with him, and so we could talk about them. I will say, though, that the seeds have been planted for many years by both of you guys, and I am very terrified at the moment.
Yeah,
because I realize that the process for reading a fiction book is very different than my process for reading a nonfiction book. So I have no idea what this is going to look like.
Well, it's like this, Mike. You read a book and you talk about it with your friends. It's really not that hard. You don't need a mind map for this one.
Okay.
Mortimer
Adler, he's not looking over my shoulder.
I bet he likes to read fiction books too. I want to just lean on you for a second on this whole fiction thing with you. I was telling Joe before we started recording that I have learned some of my best lessons in life from fictional characters or seeing like characters that I didn't like and seeing myself in them. And it's caused me to reflect on things. I really do feel like this militant anti-fiction attitude you have is a mistake. and also in addition to all that, I've just enjoyed the stories. I mean, if you've ever watched a movie, it's the same thing as reading a book in a lot of ways. I mean, I don't know. I wish you wouldn't be so against it.
That's perfectly valid. I don't have a rational reason why I don't like fiction books. I just like reading the nonfiction ones.
It's not like a bit, right? You're not just doing it just to be obstreperous.
No, I have not read a fiction book in a long time. In fact, Joe and I recorded an author's episode with Nir Eyal at one point, the author of Indistractable and Hooked. And he kind of justified my preference for nonfiction because he said he didn't read fiction books either.
Well,
so that's just there's a big pile of things to read.
Bless you
and
both.
Fiction's not on the top.
Bless you both.
Yes, absolutely. I'm with you 100% because it doesn't make any sense. Like, wait, why would you watch a movie and then think it's really good and get into the story, and yet you're against that exact thing just in the written form? Why is the TV okay, but the written form is not? It's the same concept, only the written form is better.
Yeah. And getting back to what I said earlier about life lessons, the reason I feel like I do learn from fiction books is because you get introspection from the characters about what they're thinking, and you compare that to your life, and you think about it, and it inspires you to be better or helps you fix a problem. I get that it's not as on the nose as a self-help or a productivity book, but there is definitely room in your heart for fiction books. I hope at some point you reconsider. That's all.
Well, I reconsidered at least once. So.
There you go. enough preaching. Let's talk about our towels, guys. Because if you're going to read one fiction book, I think you picked the right one.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's a good one. I enjoyed it. Although I came into this having been familiar with the movie, so this is totally not the way you should approach a fiction book, probably, because the movies are always not like the books. And Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy has been one of my favorite movies for a long time. Although I don't watch a whole lot of movies. We tend to watch the same movies over and over again. But that was one that I just really enjoyed, and it was cool to see how different the books were. With this one specifically, it's kind of interesting because I think I haven't gotten all the way through all five of the books in the set yet. But I believe that movie, they did it with Douglas Adams, the author, and they kind of mashed up a bunch of the books together into one production. So it was interesting to see like which parts were from the first book and how out of order things tended to be. But I still think that movie, it kind of tells a cohesive story. So it was kind of interesting to see kind of a remix of this whole universe and then how the books added, obviously, a ton more detail.
Yeah. Just to set the stage, I was 12 years old when this book came out, and all my friends and I read it. We talked about it at school. I really feel like the fiction aimed at our age group up until that time, there was nothing like this. And it's just like Star Wars blew our mind. This book blew our mind too. But now both of you, this is your first read for both of you, because Joe, you had not read it up until getting ready for today. And it's just a function of age. I mean, if I hadn't grown up in the 80s, I probably wouldn't have read it either. But I do think it's interesting that, you know, my first kind of approach to this was as a 12-year-old, and I had not read it again since just last week. So it had been a long time for me. And then you guys read it for the first time as adults. And I'm very curious to see if that changes your love or lack of love for the book.
Yeah, I feel like it could go both ways. But yeah, you're absolutely right. This is the first time I've gone through this one. I also have not seen the movies at all. Like movies? So just one? Multiple?
Just one. Yep.
Just one? Yeah, just I've one. Not seen it. So this was completely, completely new on my side.
Yeah, and I know there's like super fans out there that are already banging their heads because this actually wasn't written as a book. It was a radio series that they turned into a novel. And I remember talking to somebody at once that told me, and this was when I was a kid, so I don't know if it's true or not, that Douglas Adams was finishing chapters and scripts for this thing literally as he was getting out of the cab at the BBC studio. So it was kind of, you know, he just kind of put it together in this serial format, and then it was only later it turned into a book.
So it was a podcast before podcasts were a thing. Huh?
Yes, there you go.
Perfect.
The podcast this is the end good of the format. Universe.
I guess we should... Should just start with, you know, what you guys think of it. What would you think, Mike?
I really enjoyed it. The end of the book is very different than what I had expected based on the again, I did this the wrong order. I watched the movie a bunch of times first. But it was a fun read, and I feel like there's a lot more nuance to the characters that I understand now. Having read the books.
Oh, wait a second. You mean like when you read a fiction book, you learn more about characters? Huh.
Well, it's different. It's different too. So like in the movie, you can tell like the ship's computer, Eddie, has a cheerful disposition, right? And that comes across in the movie. But what you don't see in the movie is the fact that Zaphod absolutely hates this computer and is like, cussing it out all the time, telling it to shut up. At one point, he says, Eddie's like, hey, I can calculate that for you. And he's like, no, I'm going to do it on a piece of paper.
Yeah.
Because he just doesn't want to interact with it at all.
Yeah. All the characters are so, like, they're just so funny. I mean, I really do think my opinions of this book is colored by 12-year-old Dave because I just found it so delightful. Like, remember when I first learned that Marvin walked in a circle for how many thousands of years or something, you know, because one leg was broken, and that just made me laugh so hard when I was 12. I don't know why.
Because as a 12-year-old, you're visualizing this little creature going round and round in circles forever, and for whatever reason, that is what it takes to make kids laugh for days on end.
And for whatever reason, in my head, he was more like IG-88, kind of tall and lanky, but you know, whatever. What about you, Joe? What'd you think of it going through it the first time?
So I'm not coming at this from the stance of I don't want to read fiction. I'm coming at this from the stance of my normal, how do I learn from the characters in this? Because, like, for example, I'm neck deep in reading Tale of Two Cities by Dickens, and there's so much character development in that, and you spend so much time with individual characters that you kind of get into their brain.
Yeah.
When you're trying to, like, why is he in the courtroom? That doesn't make sense. Why is he even there? But you don't find out for many, many chapters later. And there's so much in Hitchhiker's Guide here that I feel is somewhat similar to that. I feel like the character development's not as deep as what like Dickens does, but it's also not near as long.
A little highbrow there. Yeah, I get it.
Yeah. So there is that piece. But at the same time, I'm completely fascinated with the process that Adams goes through here, because it just seems like, and when you explain like the whole serial development of this and how he's writing it as he's getting out of the cab, like that makes so much sense, because there's some of these pieces, like the missiles just turn into a sperm whale. Like what? Like how do you come up with that?
Yeah.
So it's fascinating and I love it, but it's just not what I was expecting at all. So I love it.
I was going to say the same thing, that understanding now that it was written as a radio show and essentially the chapters are the individual episodes, it makes a lot more sense how it was put together, because you're just kind of dropped in the middle of these crazy situations. I mean, it is a science fiction book, so it's going to be a little bit out there anyways. But like you said, Joe, there is no character development and it almost works in the book's favor.
Yes.
At least at the beginning. Absolutely. Maybe there is more in some of the other books in the series, but.
Yeah, I mean, but he was so genius, you know, even though he was kind of putting this together as he went along, he did tell a narrative and he did tell a story and he made endearing characters. For me, the last time I read it was literally 40 years ago. And the things that stuck in my head the most were the details about the characters more than the actual story. Like, I love the idea of Zaphod being put in a room where he's shown his relative importance to the entire universe, this room that makes everybody go crazy. When so if you haven't read the book, at one point they put this character in this room to show him how insignificant he is in the scheme of the whole universe, but he comes out of it fine. And they're like, well, how come you were okay? And he's like, well, I'm the center of this all, you know? And I just like, yes, you know, it's just like, and I've met those people. I still meet Zaphod.
Yeah. There was an interesting section in the book on his character specifically, where he tells a little bit of his story, how he stole the ship Heart of Gold. And essentially what the book said is that he gets these crazy ideas and they always work. And he's like, I don't know why they work, but they always end up working. And so he's just kind of been trained and conditioned to whatever crazy idea he gets, he's just gonna go do it. And that again makes way more sense around all of his mannerisms and all of his ways. You kind of see like the motivations behind them in a way that I didn't before. If you, again, I know there's a lot more detail in the book, but if you just watch the movie, you're just like, oh, this is a self-centered jerk. But you kind of get an idea of like how he got to that point, because he just gets these crazy ideas. I'm going to go steal this ship. I'm going to become the president of the universe. And then like kind of against his best efforts not to succeed, because he never plans or organizes anything, he just ends up being successful anyways. And so he just looks for one more ridiculous thing, you know, to do.
But don't you all know people like that? I mean, I know people in my life that whatever they do, they come out smelling like a rose, and it seems like they never planned for anything. And that, I don't know, I find that character present in my life.
Yeah, definitely. They're maddeningly
they're totally
frustrating.
Maddening, yes. And I don't like associating with them, because it's like, wait, why is that so easy for you? I've spent how many years trying to make that work? You spent 4 minutes on it and it worked for you. What? Please go away. You're going to make me depressed.
So, characters, thumbs up. Sounds like you guys like the characters.
I do. I think I identified a little too much with Arthur Dent.
Yeah.
He's always freaking out about stuff.
I can see a little Arthur Dent in you, Mike. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll join David on that one.
who's your favorite job. Character, Joe?
Honestly, as weird as this is, I think Ford is my favorite.
Yeah, sure.
And there's so much that I think I'm frustrated by Ford as we go through the whole thing, where it's like, oh, we're all going to die. Like, he's just going to die. Like, I don't resonate with him, like in having the same mindset, but he's very, this is exactly what's going to happen. Like, it's very plain whenever he says things. And at the same time, he's very frustrated when things don't go bad, I guess, would be the way to come at that. Because he's expecting the worst almost at every single turn. And then Zaphod is there just making everything magically work right away.
Yeah.
And it's, I don't know, I think I like the, what would that be, juxtaposition between those two and how it's just complete opposites. But
yeah,
for whatever reason, I just was fascinated by Ford.
I think my favorite characters are really all the side characters, the people who come in and out, because they're just so funny, all of them. I mean, Marvin probably chief among them, but if I had to relate to a character, I would probably put myself in Arthur Dent there with Mike. I feel like that's kind of my life sometimes. You know, I've had people hand me towels and I'm not sure why, but I take them and I keep going, you know?
Yeah. I find the Vogons kind of fascinating. Not that like I want to be like them or anything, but just their whole thing, like how they got the way they were. At one point in the book, they talk about how the planet that they're from, basically the evolutionary process broke for a while with the Vogons and then tried to make it up by making these incredible creatures after the fact.
Yeah.
And it talks about how they're just purely bureaucratic and they don't think, they just run things, you know.
Yeah.
I thought that was a pretty brilliant characterization.
Or even like the destruction of the Earth was just a bureaucratic thing where they're building an overpass, you know, just the whole idea of that, you know.
Yes.
It's like completely random. Or was it?
They had the opportunity. They could have filed a complaint, you know. They just had to go 4 light years away and then they could have filed a complaint. But that was, you know, it's interesting you brought that up, David, because that whole thing, like, it's all condensed down into a very short period at the beginning, right? Where Arthur is having his house destroyed because they want to build an overpass on the Earth over his house. Yeah. So then he ends up losing his house, right?
Yeah.
And then they're doing the exact same thing, but with the entire Earth.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because so many times, you know, extrapolate this out into life. Like, so many times we get caught up in like a small problem that seems very big to us and we pitch a fit over it, but then we realize later on, oh wait, there's this great big overarching thing that's destroying my entire world without me even being aware of it when I'm so focused on this one little tiny problem. Yeah. Like, it, anyway, that was just kind of what came to mind with that, because, you know, the same thing can happen at many different levels without us realizing it.
So true. What about the story? How'd you like the story, the way it moved and the plot points?
I really enjoyed the story. Like I said, I wasn't super happy about the end of the book. I don't want to give away any spoilers, I guess, but if you,
at this point, it's okay.
1979. I guess. So, in the book, they are trapped basically. And then Marvin convinces the police that are there basically that they're gonna, that there's no point in living anymore. And so they commit suicide and then they leave and they go to the restaurant at the end of the universe. Yeah. It's very anticlimactic. But other than that, like it was great. I thought it was fascinating when they finally get to Magrathea and the entire planet has been in hypersleep for millions of years.
Yeah.
And they're just waking up as the galactic economy is coming back.
Yeah.
So yeah. Lots of little things like that are very fascinating. And I feel like he does a really great job of giving you just enough so you feel like you know what's going on without slowing things down to explain everything.
Yeah. Before I forget, I just want to say, if you like Douglas Adams and you want to read current fiction by someone with the same style wit, I would recommend an author named Jasper Ford with 2 F's. He has young adult fiction and he has adult fiction. He does like, he does one that's a novel that takes place inside Jane Eyre. And then he's got another one about dragon trainers and they're all written with this whimsy in them. But I just, that's kind of an aside. I agree with you though. I think it's a good story, and I do think the reason for that ending was this was a hit on BBC Radio. I mean, they realized by the end that this was going to be more than one thing, and I think at some point they're like, "Don't tie it up in a bow, you know, leave them hanging. We'll have you back next year and do it again." I mean, at that point, they realized they had a hit radio show. I don't think they realized they had a cultural phenomenon on their hands.
Yeah, no, I could totally see that. And again, I'm comparing the movie as my first conditioning, but it's essentially the same ending to the movie, but it feels a lot more satisfying.
Yeah.
Like one of the details in the book, the pan-dimensional beings, the mice on Earth that have been trying to figure out the ultimate question, they are going to take Arthur's brain because he was on Earth when they would have gotten the answer.
Yeah.
And then they just kind of stumble on a different question. They're like, oh, that's good enough. And then they just leave, you know.
Yeah.
The movie is very much more confrontational and feels more like there's a satisfying outcome from it. One detail I got from the story though that I'd missed in the movie, I knew that Earth blew up and that was the supercomputer created by Deep Thought. But the book says that it was a 10 million year program and it got blown up 5 minutes before it completed.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I like how the mice once in a while would just drop dead to screw with human scientists.
Yeah. Isn't that frustrating when you're 5 minutes away from getting the answer and it all shuts down?
Yeah. Going back and reading the book again, I really enjoyed it. I'm going to go and read the rest of them again, not immediately, but within the next year, I'm going to work my way through. I didn't even realize that Owen Koffler wrote a sixth one. So there's actually another book out there that I haven't read.
I saw that. I wasn't sure which one to get off of Amazon because some of them had five and some of them had six.
Yeah. What I would say is, and I don't want to sour you because now you're reading fiction, but none of them to me were as good as the first one. I just loved this first book so much.
Well, I feel like there's a lot of stuff in the movie that I have not gotten to in the books, and I want to find those scenes. Like book number four is called So Long and Thanks for All the Fish. That's actually how the movie opens.
Yeah.
So like I keep looking for those things because the movie again was made with Douglas Adams. So I'm sure they took some creative liberties there, but from my understanding, it is like a mashup of all of the books. And so I kind of want to like go find those other scenes. I do think they did change a few things to tell a cinematic story in the movie. Like one of the things I noticed was in the book, Zaphod's already got the coordinates for Magrathea instead of having to go get the coordinates from what's the guy he ran against, Hama Kavula.
Yeah.
I think I'm sure he pops up later, but he's not even mentioned in this first book.
Yeah.
So a lot of loose ends I got to tie up in my brain.
Sure.
I occasionally, because I live near the ocean or close enough, I go swimming in the ocean, and I also go to Hawaii every 2 or 3 years. And so I bump into porpoises and dolphins, and I still look at them funny. I'm like, you know, what are you guys really doing here?
Somewhat off topic, but have you seen like all the drone footage of the great whites off the coasts of California?
That's becoming
a thing.
I know.
Like, wait, we've been swimming amongst sharks much longer than we thought we have. And now I never want to go to the ocean. I'm sorry. It's like, I'll stick to Minnesota.
Well, I've got like at some point when I got to 50, I can't surf anymore. I'm just no longer coordinated enough. I just end up wiping out all the time. So I'm switching to boogie boarding. But I think that actually makes me a bigger target for sharks. So, you know, sure. I'm not sure if that's something I should be doing right now. And your legs are hanging off, you know. That's an aside. So, Mike, have you talked to your son about it since you read it?
Yes, we've talked about it. And it's interesting. He has a very analytical mind like I do.
Yeah.
And so he notices all of the little details that are different. So like in the movie, the Vogon Destructor Fleet, it's basically this, they're gray, dull looking cube shaped ships, but in the book they're yellow. And he's like, hey, they're supposed to be yellow.
Yeah.
You know, stuff like that. So I have talked to him about it a little bit. He's still ahead of me. He's almost done with the second book. So I got to catch up with him. And I think once we're both through the whole series, we'll have a cool conversation about it. One of my favorite things about this whole thing, though, is the way that the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy defines things, like those big monologues, which tend to be italicized text of like, this is the book speaking.
The entry. Yeah.
Yeah. Those are awesome. Because some of them, like the entry for Earth is just harmless.
Yeah.
You know, and Ford is there for 15 years because he's updating the entry. And at the end of those 15 years, he's changed it to say mostly harmless. But then it talks about how, like the dolphins, for example, and it goes into this big, long monologue about how humans have always assumed they were the most, the smartest species, but actually they were the third smartest. Second were, of course, dolphins.
Yeah.
You know, and then they go into this big, long description. They did the same thing when they talk about the Vogon poetry, like the absolute worst poetry was written by this person. It has nothing to do really with like the point that it's making.
Yeah.
But it reads really well and it makes it a lot more fun, I think.
Just the overall, I think why this book was so fun to me as a kid was the whimsy of it. I just never read a book that, like, you know, didn't bang you on the head with every joke. This book just throws them out and you can pick them up or not as you go through it. And I wanted to pick every one of them up.
Yeah, because there's a lot of detail in this, like whether you realize it or not. Like this is it's fascinating to me that he was writing this so quickly, because it seems like there's so much kind of nuance, I guess, and subtleties with it that Adams must be borderline genius, because there's just so much there. When like you're talking about, Mike, like the yellow structures that are coming from the sky, or this little device that Ford has in his pocket that has told him that this was coming for a long time, even though no one was aware of it. And he knew exactly when the world was going to end. Like, these are all really tiny details, and I love it. Like, there's just so much there. I feel like you could read this a handful of times, like, and go through the entries and what's going on with the dolphins and why does this entry to Earth have to be so short? Well, Earth is so insignificant. Like, there's just so much of that. I need to read this again. I feel like I've missed a lot going through it just once.
It's interesting too, because it's science fiction, right? And it was written in 1979. And I was a little bit apprehensive going into it that the technology that they would be describing would feel old. You know, it's kind of like you watch Back to the Future, and in 2015, they think everybody's going to have hoverboards, but all of the displays still look like 8-bit graphics. Yeah. It just feels weird. And he gives enough detail for you, like I said, to kind of understand what's going on and feel like you have a grasp of things, and he paints this effective mental picture in your brain, but he doesn't give you too much. Where I think if you did, you would have some of the danger of over-describing things based on 1979 technology, and then you feel like, well, that's not, you know, that would break the illusion. And that did not happen for me in the first book.
Yeah, even like he's just hand-wavy in the right parts, you know, like the actual Guide to the Galaxy, he's just vague enough to describe it that you kind of understand. Like in my head, it's like some kind of tiny Kindle, but way better, you know, but he doesn't give enough detail to it that you're stuck with his conception. So much of this is left up to your imagination.
Yep, absolutely. And it's interesting also to see where in the movie they have intentionally, I think, to move the story along, left out certain things. So like when they hitch the ride on the Vogon destructor fleet, in the book, there's actually a whole nother race of beings that you don't even learn about in the movie itself. They're the ones who serve all the food because they're really good cooks. And so they're the ones that took them on because they know that Vogons hate hitchhikers, and they did it kind of just to make them angry.
Yeah.
So there's always like that picture or that question in the back of my head when I was watching the movie, like, how did they get on there anyways? If the Vogons hate hitchhikers, how did they, you know, show up in the washroom? And then the book kind of ties up those loose ends.
Yeah. I mean, it just, It's really fun. But I thought, you know, a lot of people who read the books were militantly against the movies. And I thought the movie was fine, but it's not the books, you know. I mean, as somebody told me once, a movie is a short story compared to a novel. And I think that's there's real truth to that.
True. Although I will say it did not take me very long to read through this one. I didn't time myself, but it couldn't have been more than like 3 or 4 hours to get through the whole book.
Yeah, it's a quick one. I mean, that's a good fiction writer, right? Like where you're so sucked into it. I had that whenever I read The Lord of the Rings. Like I just did not want to put it down. Or like I just finished reading the Chronicles of Narnia series with my girls at night. And the thing with C.S. Lewis is he's very good at, like, if you try to stop at any paragraph, it's a cliffhanger. I found that out because, like, we would read to a certain point and then I had to stop so that the girls could, you know, go to sleep. If you ever stopped at a certain paragraph, it didn't matter which paragraph you chose to stop at. It was a cliffhanger. And the girls would always, Dad, why are you stopping? It's like, it's bedtime. Sorry. Like, yeah. So they were always, frankly, it was nice because then it would make them hurry up and get ready for bed the next night because they wanted to know what happened. So there is that. There. But I'm also kind of curious, like with Hitchhiker's Guide, it's like, I feel like this could be a good book to read to them at night too. So I don't know if I'm going to do that or not, but you know, with a 4-year-old, how would that go over? I don't know. We'll see. I don't know that I should start that quite yet.
Yeah. I think 4-year-old is too young, honestly, to kind of appreciate the humor of it, but just wait a few years.
Right. Yeah, for sure. I think 2 or 3 years out, I think I may do that with them.
That Jasper Ford Dragon series would be great for your girls. I bet they would love it because the heroine is a girl and she's awesome.
The Dragon series. I'll look it up.
Yeah.
One thing I noticed as I was reading through this, because almost every book that I read with the intention of talking to Joe about it on Bookworm.
Yeah.
So I'm taking notes as I go. And I, again, knew I was going to be talking about this book, but every time I felt a mental urge to write something down, I had no idea what I would write down. So I had to break that nervous tick in my brain and just keep going through the book and enjoy the story, which felt really weird.
I remember when you told me you were going to do this, I was thinking, but how is he going to read a book that doesn't have 3 concise parts to it? Because every productivity book has 3 parts. And this doesn't.
It's true.
I love that you call it a nervous tick to take notes on a book.
It feels like I'm doing something wrong if I'm not taking notes as I'm reading it. I just become so accustomed to doing that. So I had to fight that for sure.
Well, I'll tell you, it's funny because when I grew up, another bit of media that I loved as a kid was E.T., the movie E.T., you know, came out about the same time as this book. And and I loved it. And then I didn't watch it for a long time till I had my own kids and I watched it with them. And the interesting thing for me is when I watched the movie as a kid, of course, I associated with Elliot, you know, the little boy that's got the alien that came to him. But then when I watched it as an adult, I associated with the character they call Keyes, you know, the scientist that's trying to figure out what the heck's going on. And it was very interesting to watch a movie from 2 entirely different vantage points, you know, just stick 30 years between and you'd be surprised. So I was wondering if that would happen when I read this book. And I'll tell you that I just immediately went back to 12-year-old mode as I read this book. There was no adult Sparky at all involved with this.
Sure.
I love it.
I think my favorite scene in the whole book was the part where they are trying to enter Magrathea and they fire the missiles at them and then they hit the improbability drive and they turn into the whale, like you mentioned, Joe, and a bowl of petunias.
Yeah.
And that whole monologue in that section is brilliant. They talk about how the whale has a very short time to come to grips with its existence. So it's going through this whole thing. What's my purpose in life? Why am I here? What's this thing rushing past my head? You know, and it starts naming things. And then it ends by saying, the only thing that went through the mind of the bowl of petunias was, oh no, not again. And then he adds a detail of like, and scientists believe that if we understood why the bowl of petunias thought that, we would vastly, we have a vastly better understanding of how the universe worked. It just leaves it right there.
Yeah, I mean that is Douglas Adams at his best. Yeah, and you know, and the whole cultural phenomena of the number 42, it's like secret code among nerds. Like if you look at a lot of my field guides, every time I do a calculation or I have an icon or something, it's got the number 42 on it. And some people get it and some people don't. And it's just, you know, this was a big deal when it came out.
Sure. I remember seeing that 42 on James Thompson's PCALC and immediately recognizing, oh, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. That's awesome.
Yeah. And he was, just for Apple nerds, Doug Adams was a big Apple nerd. You know, he did all this stuff on a Mac.
Nice. I did not know
and
that.
And now you know why the book is so successful.
Because it just works.
That's all it takes.
Actually, this part he didn't write on a Mac because the Mac didn't exist yet. But I know later he was an avid Mac user. Well, Mike, you read a fiction book and it didn't kill you. What's the next one?
I did. Probably the second book in the series. I forget what the names of them all are, but my son's got it right now. As soon as he's done, I'm going to pick up that one. I got to tie up all these loose ends in my brain. I got to see how Douglas Adams intended this whole universe to be described.
I keep coming back to Jasper Ford because I feel like he's such a like successor to Douglas Adams. I want to send you the Dragon, the Last Dragon Slayer series. In fact, I may just mail it to you. I'd love that. I bet you, if I send it to you, then you'd feel like you're compelled to read it, right?
So that's maybe true. I absolutely would feel that pressure.
Yeah. Oh, that's how we need to do this. Just send him the books.
Yeah. But the, I feel like your son, if your son likes these books, he would really enjoy that as well. So that'd be a good one.
Sure.
Once he's done with it. Let me know when he's done. I'm going to send the Schmitz family a present.
Will do. So, Joe, we always rate books at the end of Bookworm. How would you rate Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy?
Oh, you're going to make me do that? Oh, okay. Let's see. How do you rate a fiction book when I've spent how many years rating nonfiction books? How do you even translate that? I feel like this is all about you. You get to go first. This, all right. I'm not going first on this.
Sure. Well, it's still not the thing for me, but I did enjoy it. So I'm going to rate it 4.5. I feel like there's probably another fiction book out there somewhere that will blow me away more, but I really enjoyed this one. So I'm definitely going to read the rest of the books in this series, and I will read the ones that David and you send me.
Interesting. Okay. So 4.5. That means, okay. I suppose, you know, as I'm thinking this through, it's like, okay, the story, the characters, like you keep saying, David, the whimsy involved in this. I don't know how I could rate this anything other than a 5. I really don't. I feel like it's written very well. And having read even books like what Dickens has written and Lord of the Rings and Chronicles of Narnia, like these are all classics, right? And yet I think you're like, there's so many people that absolutely love this book that I think that actually carries a little bit of weight as well. So I have to put it way up there. I really do. I'll put it at a 5.
I am so glad to be included on a Bookworm rating session because first thing I need to do is lodge a complaint. You guys got to stop this 0.5 nonsense. You know, take a stand. You know, it's 1 through 5. If you wanted to do 0.5, you should have made it 1 through 10, but you made it 1 through 5. So every time I listen to your show and you do this, I'm like, come on, man, just pick a number. It's not that hard. Okay. So the other thing I would say is the actual rating of this book should have been obvious to both of you, and you both got it wrong. The number is 42.
Fair enough.